Today we are going to be finishing up the English Reformation. Last week we looked at the beginnings and origins of the English Reformation with Henry VIII, and then Edward VI, Mary, and then Elizabeth, and how the political situation in England really dictated the development of the English church in large part. So today we're going to be looking at the second of this, and most of our time is going to be focused today on the English Puritans. We're also going to be looking at a couple of dissenting groups that dissented from the Puritans and among the reforming English Protestants. So we're going to be looking at Baptists. We're going to be looking at Independents, which are basically Puritans that just don't believe in a Presbyterian form of government. And if we have time, maybe the Quakers a little bit. So let's go ahead and we'll start by reviewing what made the beginning of the English Reformation different. And this was that it was exclusively political. So whereas on the continent, the Reformations were really driven by theological, doctrinal, practical types of differences with the Catholic Church that then manifested themselves in political ways, where rulers took over and endorsed Protestant beliefs and then had to come into conflict with Catholic nations and rulers around them. The English Reformation is really different in its origins, anyway, in that it is a politically originated Reformation. It starts with politics. Henry VIII does not desire or want and works very hard not to have any sort of doctrinal or practical changes to the church. But once all of Henry VIII's kind of succession issues get played out with all of his children in tow coming through, so Edward, Mary, and then Elizabeth. Once Elizabeth gets to the throne, we're going to have a new form of English Reformation come about. And a lot of people talk about the English Reformation really only begins when Elizabeth gets to the throne. And that's going to be because after Elizabeth's reign, and even during her reign, the Reformation in England is not going to be directed any longer by political motivations. Their politics are still going to play, as we're going to see, a great role in the English Reformation and the Reformation that takes place after Elizabeth. But the majority of the pushing and the directing of the Reformation is going to be from reformers who are seeking to either doctrinally or practically change the way that the church practiced. And that's going to have political ramifications. Instead of politics driving the Reformation, we're going to have the Reformation really driving politics. And that's the big difference really between these two things. And this is all going to start because really Elizabeth creates a perfect storm in that she allows a church to develop in which it's going to become called the Anglican Church, although that's really not going to be an appropriate term yet, because what we think of as the Anglican Church is going to develop in opposition really to what the Puritans desire for the English church. So what you're going to have is two factions, and we'll talk about that in a second. But what Elizabeth wants the church to be like is what her father's church was like. She wants to go back and be basically Catholic, but just have her as the head, or she's going to be called the governor of the church, not the head of the church. She wants to return to the Book of Common Prayer and all these other things, and she's going to do that. She's going to do that. And what she's going to try and do is strike out in a middle direction between these. But what she's going to do in doing this is create really an environment where people are going to have the freedom to think. They're not going to be as repressed as they were. They're going to have the freedom to think, and they're going to have the freedom to write and do all these things. They're not going to be repressed like they were under Mary and persecuted, at least at the beginning. But there's going to still be this outward requirement of conformity. So you're going to be free to think and write and do just as long as you just at least go to the church and work. And that's going to be, for a while, is going to be a good solution until beliefs start moving beyond this outward ability to conform anymore. And that's what we're going to see is going to happen. So this is going to bring about, once again, the problem of the Reformation is that Elizabeth wants to return to this reformed idea and some reform practices. But once this change, once again, once it gets started again, it's going to be really hard to stop. And the Puritans are going to run. And they're going to run, and people in the English Reformation are going to run far beyond where even people on the continent are going to go. Bevington, who is a Baptist and Puritan historian, talks about the Baptists as being the people who take Reformation ideas to their logical end conclusions. And that's really what we're going to see in England, is that the Reformation is really going to be pushed beyond where it's been anywhere else in a lot of ways. And then we're going to have some interesting people that come out during the English Reformation. And so we'll talk about them if we have time as well. But this middle way that we're going to talk about is that Elizabeth, while she's being forced into the Protestant camp, is not a zealot, doesn't desire any sort of real radical changes, especially the radical changes that the people around her that she's going to bring back to England from the exile of her sister Mary are going to want. And she's going to be we talked about this a little bit last week, but she's going to have to try and hold in two different groups of people. The radical Protestants, which are going to make up a very small percentage of the population at the beginning of her reign, but they're going to really be the intellectual and a lot of times the politically and wealthy. And then she's also going to have to kind of take along the Catholics who are over here that favored her sister Mary, and then everyone that's kind of in between. And so what she's going to have to do in doing this, and then all of the political situations around her, we talked about that as well, that she had to maintain alliances with Catholic countries so she couldn't antagonize them too much with her religious practices and all these different types of things. So what she's going to do is she's going to strike out with something that's going to later become called by John Henry Newman, who's an Anglican who ends up converting to Catholicism in the 1800s, what he calls the via media, which is this Latin for middle way. So it's going to be doctrinally, it's going to be Reformed Protestant. So when we get to Elizabeth and she passes something called the 39 Articles, the 39 Articles are right in line with Calvin's tradition as far as Reformed doctrines of salvation and all that kind of stuff goes. But it's going to retain the structure and flavor of the medieval Catholic Church. And this is going to actually increase as time goes on rather than decrease within the Anglican Church. So while when Elizabeth starts out, and especially with her brother Edward VI before her reign, we had a lot of really Puritan type of practices coming into the church. All the images were removed, the stained glass windows were removed, different things like that. In Elizabeth's reign, and then especially after Elizabeth's reign, when we get to the guys that come after her, we're going to have a return, really, to a more of a high church practice. So this is what this middle way is going to be. Well, we can skip the next slide. I think I've already talked about it. But this brings about a problem. Here's John Knox. John Knox is familiar with problems. He causes a lot of problems and tries to solve a lot of them, too. But this middle way is going to be unacceptable for both minorities. It's going to be unacceptable for the Catholic minority, which had become more dedicated during Mary's reign. And it's going to be unacceptable for the English Protestants who had been exiled during the reign of Mary. Because during their time in the continent, they had lived in Germany, they had lived in Geneva, they had lived in the Netherlands. They had existed under political structures that were very kind to the type of Protestantism that they espoused. So their political structure was different. They'd allowed their church structure to develop and become more and more reformed. And so they're not, when they return, they're not going to want to go back to what they see as being a lot of the trappings of Catholicism. Even if the doctrine is fine, the way that the church looks and the practices of the church are no longer going to be acceptable to them. So we're going to have these two very vocal groups of minority. And you have the wealth of people that are in the middle that really don't care and are perfectly satisfied with the solution. But as often happens, it's the people who speak up the loudest, whether they are the majority of the people or not, that get their voices heard and cause what ends up happening to happen. And that's what's going to happen here. There's going to be a Catholic uprising in the north in the late 1560s. Elizabeth is going to crush this rather easily. But what's going to come out of this is Elizabeth is no longer going to tolerate any form of dissent like this. And this is going to apply both to Catholics, who were the cause of the problems, and to the Puritans as well. And she's going to enforce a law of uniformity on the clergy. And this is going to take place through her Archbishop of Canterbury, a guy by the name of Matthew Parker. And the reason where this uniformity is really going to come out is a very odd situation. And this revolves around the clothes that the pastors in the Anglican Church were required to wear It's called the vestment controversy. And this is where really where the origins of Puritanism begin, is in this controversy over what are we going to wear and what should we wear. So here's a cup is what it's called. This would have been the vestment that would have gone over the top of just the normal thing that the priest would wear. We'll see that in just a second. This controversy begins way, way back during, well, not way, way back, but two rulers ago during Edward VI's reign, when the guy that he appointed, or his council appointed to be the Archbishop of Gloucester, John Hooper, refused to be consecrated because he didn't want to wear the vestments. He thought that they were wrong. Now, eventually, people like Calvin and other people, leaders during the English Reformation, they're going to send off to Calvin and get Calvin's comments on this. And Calvin just basically says, why are you guys fighting about this? Do I really think that you should have to wear them? No. But does it really matter? No. So just wear the vestments and go on. And that's Calvin's response. And that's going to be really the Protestants on the continent's response to this. It's a non-issue. But to the Protestants in England and the people that are going to be later going to be called the Puritans, or are going to at this time start being called the Puritans, it's going to be a big deal. And once the Protestant leaders are exiled after the reign of Edward VI, people like John Knox, who's in, I believe, in Frankfurt at the time, begin doing away with vestments in their congregations. And this is going to even cause controversy within the English Protestants in exile. We have some that are doing away with vestments, some that are keeping them, some that want to hang on to the Book of Common Prayer. Knox is going to go so far as to reject the Book of Common Prayer and write his own liturgy for his church in Frankfurt. But when they come back under Elizabeth, what they're going to do is they're going to present her with a list of demands. Here's what you would wear underneath it. This is called a surplice. So that would have gone underneath the thing that we saw before. So the demands that they're going to bring are relatively moderate demands. Reduction of saint days, elimination of vestments, no kneeling to receive the Lord's Supper, no emergency baptism of infants. This means basically what would have happened is if an infant looked like it was going to die, the midwife would baptize the baby. And so they wanted to do away with that. And then no organs in the church. So these are some of them are more radical than others, but some of them would have been normal types of things. But these reforms, for the large part and for the most part, are going to be rejected. Elizabeth is going to reject these demands. And any attempt to implement them, especially the clerical dress one, since that's kind of going to be the most obvious. And some of these other ones, if you don't kneel, someone's going to have to be there to watch. But the vestments and other things like that is going to be pretty easy to catch, whether you're wearing what you're supposed to wear or not. That's a pretty visible reminder. That's going to be strictly enforced. And it's not going to be a big number, but about 37 ministers throughout all of England are going to be forced to leave the church, or are going to choose to leave the church, really. They would have been forced, but they're going to choose to leave the church. And this is really going to mark the beginning of these ministers are going to go out and form separate churches that are outside the Anglican church. And this is really going to be the beginning of what we think of as a separatist Puritan movement. Now, these people, most of them, although some of them at this time will begin moving in a more radical direction. But most of these people would have still wanted to remain part of the English church as much as they could and as much as their conscience would allow them to. And what they're really searching for, the root of this problem, is they're not satisfied with the degree that the English church has been reformed. One Puritan talks about things that have been picked off the popish dung heap and left in the church. Another one talks about that Elizabeth swept the church but left the dust still in the church. She just swept it into a pile and stuck it off in the corner, but didn't really clean up the church. There's still some of this remnant of Roman Catholicism left around, and they want to get rid of this. And what they're really calling for in the end is what most radical Protestants are calling for. They're calling for a complete destruction of the old Catholic framework and practices and the way everything looks, and a real rebuilding of the church, not just doctrinally or theologically, but practically, in the way that it looks and everything else, the way it feels, everything about it, in a more radically Protestant image. And that's what they really want. And that's what they're going to work to get. So there's going to be continued areas of conflict that the Puritans are going to have not just over vestments, but they're going to have conflicts over bishops. As early as 1517, this guy, Thomas Cartwright, is going to call in a series of lectures that he gives, I believe at Cambridge, for the abolition of bishops. So we see that it moves from the dress, now it's moving more towards the whole structure of the English church is flawed, it's wrong, we need to get rid of this, bishops are wrong, we need to move towards the Presbyterian model. Now, of course, vestments are going to continue to be a controversy. The Book of Common Prayer, which was a controversy for Knox and others, they're going to feel like it hangs on with too much of Roman Catholic ideas and tendencies, the elevating of the host, and the fact that it's a set liturgy. There's not really any room for preaching or any kind of extemporaneous type of ministry in it. And then the big one is going to be preaching. It ties in with the Book of Common Prayer. Now, they're going to go so far, especially in the realm of bishops, which is going to be the main area of contention here in a lot of ways. And also the Book of Common Prayer is going to be a big one too. But they're going to go so far as to claim that the Bible demands a Presbyterian form of government. That it's actually, that's a divine right that we have, that we get Presbyterian type of government. They would read these ideas into the Scripture. And then you're going to have people that are going to move even beyond that form of, we don't want any sort of governance over the local church. We want local churches to be autonomous. And this is going to be the rise of the independents and the separatists. So let's look at distinctive characteristics then. A lot of these are going to revolve around these areas of conflict. The preaching ministry is going to be one of the distinctive characteristics of Puritanism, the role of preaching. One of the things that had grown out of the late medieval English church was with the Lollards, and they're going around the countryside preaching, the kings of England had enforced a law that if you wanted to preach, you had to be licensed to preach. So, if you wanted to preach, if you wanted to do anything other than just read the liturgy from the text of the Roman liturgy or eventually the Anglican liturgy, you had to be licensed. And by the time of the Puritans, only about 10% of England's about 40,000 clergy were licensed to preach. So only a very small number of people were actually licensed to preach. And this is a problem for the Puritans, especially because they want this sort and they demand this sort of expounding of God's word. But Elizabeth prefers the liturgy over preaching. She doesn't like the preaching. But aided by a lot of wealthy patrons, a lot of noblemen who begin intellectually supporting the Puritans, they're going to found a number of colleges at the major universities of Oxford and Cambridge and a number of other ones for training preachers. And this is going to allow for a slow formation of a lot of preachers. And what you really have developing with this preaching ministry is really in a lot of ways two different styles of worship that are beginning in England. You have a service which is devoted to preaching in which the liturgy, this is within the Anglican church, I'm not talking about the separatists now, so I don't want you to think, but within the regular Anglican church that would have been fine with everyone except for the separatists and the Catholics, you would have had two really different forms of worship that developed. A shortened liturgy where you have a preacher expounding upon a text of Scripture, and then another service that retains a lot of the fixed liturgy from the Book of Common Prayer. And so you really are having two separate streams that are developed even within the Anglican church. Okay? So this is what this is. Then you also have an importance of personal piety that's going to be important to the Puritans. As Elizabeth's reign goes on, and as she's more and more repressive and the people around her are more and more repressive of any sort of dissent, this turns the Puritans inwardly. Instead of seeking to reform the church, they seek to reform their own inward lives and begin leading lives of high personal piety. And it's also going to lead to a withdrawal from the world. Because they're being repressed and because they're being forced out of politics and a lot of other things and their influence within the church, they're going to withdraw from the world. And they're going to start looking at the world as an evil place. And this is going to lead them to having a sort of kind of a subculture, which they're going to have a subculture mindset, but they're going to look at the things that the normal English population would have enjoyed, things like theater and certain types of music. They're going to start looking at those as being evil and wicked and beginning to speak out against them. So Elizabeth dies eventually after a very long reign. her cousin, James the First of Scotland, is going to be appointed King of England. And for a brief moment, the Puritans are excited. While James's mother, Mary, Queen of Scots, had been Catholic, when she probably was complicit in the murder of her husband and married his probable murderer, the Scottish lords said that's enough and kicked her out. And her one-year-old son, James, was crowned king. He was taken away from her care. He was sent and tutored by Presbyterian Puritans. And so here is a king now that's finally been raised from the time of his birth, much like Edward VI, by Protestant Puritans, people that they would have felt comfortable with. They're very excited about this. They are. And before James even reaches London, when he leaves Scotland and on his way to London, he's met by a delegation of Puritans who hand him what's called the millenary petition. It's signed by 1,000 Protestant or Puritan clergy, and it basically just sets forth their demands. These are the things that we would like to see happen. The next year, he's going to call a big conference at his court at Hampton Palace, and in this, he's going to reject the Protestant demands. James has not enjoyed, while he was King of Scotland, the amount of authority that the church has had over the government and the lack of power that he's had. And when he gets to England and finds the amount of power that he has over the church and the ability to shape it through the bishops, he wants to hang on to that. He goes so far as to say, no king, no bishop. No bishop, no king. That idea that both of them, to have one, you have to have the other. It doesn't work without the other. So they're going to... he's going to reject this. But what were their demands? I mean, some of their demands sound to us kind of weird. The Protestants demanded that the sign of the cross be removed during baptism, confirmation be done away with. Once again, no baptism by lay people, so midwives and things like that. The outlawing of rings in marriage, bowing at the name of Jesus, vestments again gone, men are given the doing away with multiple ecclesiastical positions, the use of the term priest in absolution, and then they wanted a couple of things. They wanted stricter observance of the Sabbath. They wanted a more distinct separation between church and state, a move to a Presbyterian form of government is what you should think there, and more preaching. So we see that since the time of Elizabeth, their demands and their thoughts and their ideas have evolved. Even going so far as not just that we're not going to use certain symbols, but even rings in marriage, we're going to get rid of those because those are symbols of something and we don't want that. And it's going to go even further. But James is going to reject this. He does allow for a few minimal changes. He's going to change words like absolution and confirmation to different terms. He's going to outlaw baptism by midwives or just remove it from the liturgy and from the practice. And he's also going to call for a new authorized English translation of the Bible during this conference, which we're going to know as the King James Version of the Bible, which Puritans wanted, but in the end didn't enjoy as much as they thought they probably would have. Which time do I have left? Okay. So this is going to lead to Protestant disappointment. Obviously, here they had built this up. They thought that James was going to be their savior in a lot of ways. He was going to allow them to continue to reform the church. And with James's rejection of their reforms, this is really going to begin driving the Puritans in two directions. It's going to begin driving them out of the English church altogether. And this is where we're going to have the beginning of separatist movements like John Smith, who ends up forming the first Baptist congregation in the Netherlands, is going to evolve out of this time period. But it's also going to drive the Protestants to the king's political enemies. And this is going to be driving them into the arms of radical members of Parliament. This is going to be important later on because the Puritans and Parliament are going to begin tying themselves and their ideas together. And that's when we get to the English Civil War. That's going to be important. So this is what the disappointment leads to. Now, eventually, the Stuarts are going to end up being, I call them the stupid Stuarts, because they're not very good rulers, really. They favor an absolute form of government. So this means absolute control over Parliament, over political situations, and over the church as well. And that's going to apply both in England and in their realm of Scotland. And so James is going to start trying to force the English system of church government on the Scots. He's going to do that very slowly. James is smarter than his son will be, but still not incredibly smart. And they lack fiscal responsibility. That what ends up happening is because the English kings are trying to enforce their will on Parliament, they don't call Parliament very often. And it's only if Parliament is called can the kings generate any new forms of revenue. Parliament is, the way the English system works, is the kings have their own land and their own individual streams of revenue that they could use to run their government. But if they needed more money than that, they had to call Parliament. And only Parliament could levy taxes, or certain types of taxes, for so many years for the king. And so that since the Stuarts weren't very responsible financially, and because they fought a number of wars that they couldn't pay for, this eventually lands them in tricky financial situations where they're going to be forced into calling Parliament into session. And by that time, Parliament's going to be very angry with them and really run by Puritan members. All right, so we can move to the next slide. Another thing that they're going to do in their attempt to reform the English church is they're going to begin what we really call high Anglicanism, or high church. And this is started by someone named, a major proponent of it. It's not necessarily just started by him. The guy by the name of William Laud. Here's a picture of him. And Laud's idea is, and it's a good idea, it's not a bad idea. It's the beauty of holiness. This idea that holiness should be beautiful. And for him, that meant a love of ceremony and liturgy. It's the repair and beautification of church buildings, things that had been destroyed during the early parts of the English Reformation and left untended. During the ensuing years, you're going to be forced to repair your church. You're going to be forced to make it look nice. You're going to be forced to keep it up. And he's also going to restore the altars to the church. And he's going to begin fencing them off with a railing that would have separated the communion table from the body. And Puritans would have viewed all of these things as the reintroduction of a lot of Catholic stuff that we had already gotten rid of. And they're going to be angered by this. And in beyond just instituting all these things, the persecution of dissenters is going to begin. Now, granted, the people that they're persecuting are fairly outspoken, radical members. But this persecution is going to lead to growing resentment against Laud and against the king and other things like this. We're going to have people branded, ears cut off, flogged, imprisoned. Different things like that are going to end up happening. And so this is going to lead to what is called the Great Migration. And once again, Puritans are believing that the purification of the church is no longer possible. And between 1620, so the end of the reign of James, and the beginning of the Bishop's War and a number of other things in England, what you're going to have is about 60,000 Puritans flee England. And about 20,000 of them end up in New England. Another 5 end up in the Chesapeake Bay area and Maryland and different other colonies. And a lot of them end up in the West Indies, and some flee to the continent as well. But this is going to lead to a dramatic increase, obviously, in the population of New England in the United States. And this is where one of the reasons why New England is such a powerful area of the country at the beginning of colonial times is because of the massive influx of settlers there from England that are fleeing religious persecution. So a lot of Protestants end up leaving. Now, James and Charles's attempts to force English belief on the Scots are going to lead to what's called the Bishop's War. And this is where they're going to seek to impose English-style bishops on the Scots and take away their Presbyterian form of government. And they're also going to force a Scottish Book of Common Prayer. And in the first service in Edinburgh, during this, during when this new liturgy is being used, the people in the church actually riot. The funny story is that a lady, Jenny Geddes, threw her stool that she was sitting on at the bishop. And everyone else started throwing all their stuff at him as he was trying to read the liturgy. Eventually, they kicked all those people out. But when the bishop came out of the church, all the people attacked him in the streets, and he was only just barely able to escape with his life. And this leads to the Scottish nobles and leaders of the church begin rebelling against Charles. They form an army, Charles, James the first's son, Charles the first raises an army in England, but because of his financial situation in England, he's not able to raise a very large army, and neither the Scots nor the king is able to really win this war. And so this forces the king to call a parliament into session. This is known as the Short Parliament. The Short Parliament only lasts for about 3 weeks because they make so many demands on Charles that he's not able, he just kicks them right out again. And then he's forced into calling the Long Parliament when, after the dissolution of the Short Parliament, the Scots actually invade England. And so what you end up having happen is the king ends up, you have Parliament and the Scots really against the king. And the Parliament is going to execute not just Charles's political administration. There also, William Laud, the Archbishop of Canterbury, is going to be executed. The king is going to be defeated by the Scots in Parliament. But the victory on the part of the Puritans is going to cause a division that we probably need to talk about for just a second. And this is going to be really, so they beat the king and they've got what they wanted. At least some of them have gotten what they wanted. Some of the Puritans during this time period of the English Civil War had become even more radical and wanted to do away with the king altogether. And so the king ends up siding with some of the more moderate Protestants. They're defeated because the separatist general is the best general that England has at the time, and his army is the best army. It's Oliver Cromwell and his New Model Army. He's defeated, imprisoned. Charles is executed, and because of this, the separatists, not the Puritans, this radical wing of the Puritans come into power, and the independents are going to be the ones who run the country for about the next 11 years during the period that's called the Interregnum. And the independents were originally Presbyterians, but they rejected the Presbyterian form of church governance and wanted an autonomous local church. And they want more separation between church and state. That just means that they don't want the state imposing anything on them. That doesn't mean they don't want, same thing with Calvin in Geneva. It doesn't mean that they don't want the state, the church to have any say over the state. It just means the state needs to keep its hands off the church. And the good thing is, for people in England anyway, is that they are proponents of religious toleration. So because they have been persecuted so much, they are, and because they want the state to have its hands off the church, they are in favor of religious toleration. And this is going to be good in a lot of ways for the English church, because we're no longer going to have all this religious bickering and fighting that turns into political things. But we are going to have a lot of the radical disintegration of the Puritan movement that begins. So it just splits into 100 different directions. And because there's religious toleration, people are really free to think and preach and talk about whatever they think is true. And this is really what are going to be the time period that we see the Baptists coming in. So we can talk about them. There are three different views about Baptist origins. There's an Anabaptist view. And while the Anabaptists might have had some intellectual claim as the origins of some of the early ideas of the first Baptist, there's not really any direct connection between them. There's the perpetuity view that there have always been Baptists or people that were like the Baptists around. There's really no evidence for this. And then there's the separatist view, which is where we have almost the entirety of our evidence comes from, that Baptists originated within the separatist movement. They're going to originate with a guy by the name of John Smith. John Smith is a Cambridge fellow. He is going to be forced out of Cambridge and forced during the time of James to flee with a small group of followers that he had collected around him to Amsterdam. And it's going to be there that he's going to baptize first himself and then a number of his followers, having come to the conclusion that believers' baptism is the right way. Now, this baptism is not going to be immersion. Immersion is not going to become a standard Baptist practice for a little while still. He's going to pour. And eventually, he and the majority of his church is going to stop being Baptist, and they're going to become Mennonite. They're going to join to a Mennonite church in Amsterdam. And this is because a lot of his early beliefs were coincided with Mennonite beliefs. But not all of this congregation. And we should really, we'll come back to, these are going to be called the General Baptists later. And this is really the origins of the General Baptists, but we'll get back to them in a second and what their beliefs are. But his chief follower, a guy by the name of Thomas, yes, that doesn't look like this, but it's going to be pronounced really Ellis, is going to be returned to London. He's going to found a church in London, and that church, it appears like, will eventually disband under the stricter persecution during the reign of Charles and James, although a church will grow up right basically where it was a few years later. So let's look at the differences. What we're going to end up happened with the Baptists is really two different streams of people practicing believers' baptism are going to develop in England. And they are not in their origins, other than both coming from separatist groups, but they're really not going to be tied to each other. So you have General Baptists and Particular Baptists, and we'll look at these both together in a second. But both of them believe in self-government, although the Particular Baptists, because they come from independent origins, are going to be much, much more strict about this. The General Baptists will actually have councils or meetings, and those decisions will be governing for all bodies. They'll also have people that they'll call messengers that will be able to have the ability to go and enforce decisions over multiple churches, kind of like an apostle almost, if you want to think about them that way. They would have traveled around. Both of them do practice believers' baptism. The General Baptists are anti-Calvinistic, and by this we should mean that they believe that Christ's atonement is general, meaning for all men, and not just particularly for the elect. That sin was a result of free choice, and that you can resist the Spirit, and that there is no such thing as the perseverance of the saints. This would have been General Baptist belief. Now, this is not Arminian. I mean, we should probably point this out. This seems to stem more from contact with Mennonites than it does with Arminians. Even though both of these things would have been prevalent in Holland, it seems like the leaders of the early General Baptists don't have a lot of contact with Arminian beliefs until much later. And then they'll adopt those since they tend to tie in with their ideas. And there's actually going to be some, if we can move to the next slide, there's actually going to be a lot of early affinity with Mennonites. And a number of groups are going to be sent over to Holland to see if there's some way that they can work out some sort of union between the General Baptist churches that are developing in England at the time and the Anabaptist Mennonites that are there. But unfortunately, while they intellectually agree with a lot of the Mennonites' ideas, there are a number of ideas which thankfully they reject. The most common of these would have been that Christ didn't derive any of his physical nature from Mary. So some of these ideas were Mennonite beliefs at the time that they rejected. So the General Baptists are going to develop in London. They're typically going to be less numerous and less well-educated than their particular Baptist opponents. The leaders of the General Baptists are going to be people like soap boilers is one of them. One of them was a soap boiler. One of them was an illiterate Cooper. So they're very, very humble people. Their first confession or kind of statement of beliefs is very, very humbly worded. It's not very articulate. They're not very educated. The Particular Baptists, on the other hand, are going to be very different because their origins are going to come from Reformed churches. And the main church that this comes from is named the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church, which is just the three pastors in a row that they had. And this church is going to be divided over a number of different issues. And eventually one of those divisions is going to divide again. And this is going to become the Spilsbury Church. And this is the first church that we have that we can see holding particular Baptist beliefs and yet, particular Baptist, yes, being particular Baptist, meaning they're Reformed and are practicing believers' baptism. And they're going to, but these particular Baptists are going to maintain a close relationship with independents. So people that still practice infant baptism. And there's going to be a number of churches, the most famous of which is John Bunyan's church, which is going to have people, both believers' baptism and both people who have been baptized as infants, fellowshipping and communioning together. Although they're going to be condemned by their more, by other particular Baptists for doing this. They are staunchly Calvinistic. The 1644 confession is right in line with Reform beliefs. Christ died only for the elect. Total depravity and unconditional election, irresistible grace, holy passive reception of grace and the perseverance of the saints. And at least at the beginning, there's going to be a kind of an antagonistic relationship between these two different types of Baptists. General Baptists are going to go so far as to require those that join from a particular Baptist church to be baptized as a believer again, not recognizing the baptism of the particular Baptist church. But eventually, during the time of greater persecution after the time of Cromwell, this relationship between them is going to get better. William Kiffin, who's one of the leaders of the particular Baptists and is very wealthy and very influential with the government, will help 12 general Baptist preachers that had been arrested get out and not be executed. So this is kind of the origins of Baptists. We'll look more at them as we go on. They're going to be very, very small during this time period, during the end of the English Reformation. They're still just a small portion, but it's important that we lay the groundwork, because as we go on, they're going to become more and more important. Other groups that developed during this time are the Quakers. George Fox is the guy who starts the Quakers. Now, the Quakers are going to be interesting, and because while the Baptists really take a lot of Reformation ideas to their kind of in conclusions on a lot of different areas, the Quakers are going to push those even beyond what we would consider to be normal, ordinary Christian mainstream beliefs. And they're going to do this through a rejection of authority. The Quakers are going to reject, and Fox particularly is going to reject, all authority. He's going to refuse things like military oaths and different things like this. And also refuses to bow and take off his hat to people. He's going to use pronouns like thee and thou with everyone, regardless of who they are. And he's never going to say good evening to anyone. And he will not use the days of the week, their names, nor the month's names, but he'll just give numbers. Like, what day is it? What's one? Okay? So these types of things. He just rejects all sorts of authority, even the authority of someone naming the days of the weeks and the months for him. So he's going to reject those. He's going to support people that, like we've seen other times, that are going to walk through the street naked of cities and just crying out against the city. He's going to do things like that. He's also going to really talk about this rejection of authority is going to lead to a rejection of Scripture as an authority over him too, because he's going to claim, and what he says is, he says, we need no external guide, no minister, no authority, for we have immediate knowledge of Christ within, the inner light, the seed of divinity within the soul. So it's this idea that the Bible is not an authority over me because I have this mystic relationship with Christ, and that is my God, this inner light that I have. And while this idea is of this mystic union with Christ is something that's common during the Middle Ages and other periods, it always had the authority of the church to kind of hem in any sort of potentially bad beliefs. And this is an old heresy. We looked at this way back at the beginning of this course with the Montanists. The same idea again, and the same problem isn't necessarily right that the possibility of continued revelation isn't necessarily an extra-biblical idea, although we might argue that it is, but it's the rejection of authority that's the problem. Someone saying, no, some authority is placed over them, and they're rejecting that authority, and that sin tends to be the main problem. And this, of course, all of this weirdness is going to lead to social withdrawal. We already looked at that with the rejection of military oaths and just the oddity that they're going to have. It's also going to lead to inevitable problems are going to appear out of this, in that one of his followers is going to let himself be worshipped as the Son of God and be taken into the city of Bristol with people chanting holy, holy, holy and throwing their coats down in front of him. So you're going to get a lot of this idea of rejecting all authority. Really, you have no bounds in a lot of ways on what you can say, although Fox didn't condone that or anything like that, and we shouldn't believe that he did. All right, so later, after the end of this interregnum period, I only have just a few seconds left. So Restoration is going to come back under Charles II. A lot of the reforms done are going to be undone. New acts of uniformity are going to be passed. Private religious meetings are going to be outlawed. And really the Puritan movement is going to end here because it's going to get split. You're going to have some that go along with Charles and are just going to totally reject the English Civil War and the killing of the king and all the problems that brought on and just look at that. we see where this has gotten us. We're just going to go along. And you have other ones that buy into continued dissent. And Puritan, the word Puritan is no longer going to be used. You're going to start seeing words like nonconformist and dissenter used instead of Puritan being used as well. And this is going to lead to a period of about 12 years in which there's a lot of persecution. John Bunyan, this is the 12 years that he's going to spend in prison. It's going to happen during this time in the last slide. This is all going to be eventually overturned when James II, an openly Catholic king, the last openly Catholic king, Charles II was Catholic as well, but he was under the radar kind of thing. James eventually produces a Catholic male heir. Both of his daughters are Protestants, so that was fine. And the people in England were willing to wait James out. He was going to die without a Catholic heir. We're going to be fine. We're going to go back to Protestants. But once he produces a Catholic heir, Parliament offers the throne to his daughter and his son-in-law, William and Mary. James flees the country. We have a bloodless revolution that's called the Glorious Revolution. And then the next year after they take the throne, an act of religious toleration is passed. And this is really the end of all religious persecution for the most part in England. There'll be brief periods after William and Mary, but by the time we get to George I, which is the king, which their daughter, her sister becomes king, Queen Anne. She, a little bit of religious persecution under her, but by the time we get to the one after that, religious persecution in England is pretty much done. And we're going to look at kind of the effects of that and the intellectual shift that's happened in the church during this period, and then how that plays out in the way that the church relates to the world for the next 2 weeks after this. All right. Thank you, guys.